It is the first week of April. April is the month of renewal. It's the beginning of spring, especially in the Northeast. We finally see some relenting of winter. We see some renewal, some rebirth. It is a beautiful time in my religion of Christianity. There's a lot of meaning in this time of year. And this week for us is Holy Week. And depending on, you know, what your religious beliefs are, if you have any, this may be very meaningful for you as well. So this past weekend was Palm Sunday, and so moving for me, going to Mass every year for, you know, 5 decades, I just can't help but weep every time at Palm Sunday Mass. We do a reading of the scriptures, and the Mass population, we participate. If you've never been, it really holds something for me. You get to be the crowd that was there during the time of Jesus and participate in passing judgment and, you know, being the crowd that says, you know, crucify him, crucify him. And every year I openly weep. It just does something to my soul. So that's part of the scripture where you follow along as Jesus makes that long journey with the cross and then gets hung up on the cross and dies. And then, you know, throughout Holy Week, it follows along the journey until Christ is risen. And so this is a whole long, you know, journey of spiritual rebirth, and also one of forgiveness, one of, it starts with, you know, my God, why have you abandoned me, to all the promises fulfilled. And that, you know, beginning to the end of, you know, desolation and despair to joy and triumphant promises fulfilled is just every emotion and every feeling under the sun, and then all promises fulfilled at the end. There's so much hope in that promise. And every year I leave feeling so overjoyed with the hope of that promise fulfilled. So I've mentioned a couple of times that at this point in my life, I feel some things are just coming at me. And I have a conflict going on right now in my life where someone is coming at me. And, you know, I'm sure that we've all experienced this where it is hard to forgive when people are attacking you. And it is, you know, you have to ask yourself, do I have to forgive everybody that is coming at me? Do I have to forgive everything that happens to me? And that is a spiritual question. Is it important to forgive every slight, every attack, every possible cut? I think it is, but it is not easy to get there. And especially if the journey is not over and you are still in the middle of the battle. Do you forgive now, or do you wait until the battle is over and then work on forgiveness? So I've been working on forgiveness my whole life, and I hope that I have been forgiven and will be forgiven for all of the things that I have done and the harms that I have caused. We are not perfect people. We make many mistakes. I have made many mistakes, especially as a parent. I've made many mistakes as a leader. I've made many mistakes as an employee. I've made many mistakes as a boss. I've made many mistakes as a friend. Certainly, certainly. Oh my God, yes, as a parent. I mean, let me say that again. I have made many mistakes as a parent. Oh, I wrote about it in my book. I talked about it on this podcast. I strive every day to be better. I really do. I reach for it. I'm human and I admit my many, many flaws. But I try every day to be better and I apologize for my failings. And in acknowledgement, we seek to learn from our mistakes, right? And improve. And we hope that people will forgive us. But then let's turn that around and let me get back to my point of, you know, we need to forgive other people. But, you know, part of that forgiveness is, do people need to be sorry in order to be forgiven? Do we need to give forgiveness even if people don't admit their wrongdoing and don't admit that they have hurt us and are not sorry for what they have done? If someone keeps coming at us, do we just have to stand there and take it? So I ask these questions, I throw them out to the universe. You know, instant message me, DM me, send me your thoughts about this. What do you do when people keep coming at you? I don't think you need to stand there and just take it. I think you need to protect yourself. But forgiveness is healthy, right? You walk away, you protect yourself, but you forgive and you move on, even if that person doesn't acknowledge the hurt that they're causing, even if they keep trying to come at you. I don't know. Let me know what you think. It's a hard, hard topic, especially if it's a family member. Many of us have family members in our lives who cause unbelievable damage and, you know, for whom we cannot have a healthy relationship with them. And these are just very, very hard, hard subjects, hard topics. Anyway, this week, being Holy Week every year for me is very healing. I pray a lot, I fast, and I spend a lot of time trying to think about going beyond myself, outside of myself, and what can I do for others? Because for me, that helps me a lot, getting out of my head and going beyond myself. So I am so happy this week to present to you a really amazing person who I was overjoyed to meet, a woman whose name is Sudhi Bar, and her story is incredible. She is a survivor. She is a patient with lived experience, a wellness coach. She's from Alberta, Canada. And let me just tell you a little bit about what she has been through. As a young person, survived heart attack and stroke events and has been through an amazing recovery, navigating this road to true great mental health. Her experience with the healthcare industry was a journey like none other that I have heard. She experienced so many barriers in access to healthcare. She advocates for sex and gender equity and care. She's a blogger, a speaker, and a socioeconomic specialist with 15 plus years of expertise and so much more. So she really helps to create self-sustaining nonprofit organizations. I just could go on and on, but I really enjoyed talking to her about her overcoming her trauma, and her spirituality and her healing, and just, you know, the strength and the resilience in her recovery. So I hope that you enjoy this podcast. And please always love to hear your feedback. Please let me know your thoughts. And as always, would really, really, really enjoy any ratings and reviews that you would be kind enough to leave for us on our show. Thank you so much. And here we go.
Thank goodness I am with a phenomenal guest today, Sudhi Bar, who is going to do almost all of the talking. I know that's really hard for me because I love to talk. That's why I have a podcast. But Sudhi is here at the beginning of Women's History Month. And thank goodness, because she has a lot of things to chat about when it comes to equity in healthcare systems. And we're going to chat about a number of different things when it comes to healthcare systems. Sudhi, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you, Annette.
So, Sudhi, you are in Edmonton, Alberta, which is in Canada, a place I've never been to. And you have, well, first of all, you're a patient with lived experience. And before I get into all of your many wonderful, business expertise, can we just talk a little bit about your personal background and, you know, kind of what brings you into this field? Just about everybody that I talk to with some professional expertise really comes to this from a personal space as well. Just tell us a little bit about your life and your family and, you know, why this is such a personal cause for you.
Yes, definitely. Oh, there's so much, like your question is fully loaded. So
I know.
I'll just ramble on for a little bit. So my background is in economics. So health, socioeconomics and social determinants of health are huge aspects of my passions. That being said, throughout university, I worked as a healthcare aide for individuals with health challenges, as well as disabilities, disabilities that they were born with or inflicted with after birth, and also pediatrics, children, PEDS, who were at end stage life and who needed respite. Respite means that their parents, the child needs constant 24/7 supervision, but they obviously cannot do that because no one can be up and running around and caring for a child 24/7. So I would come in overnight as the overnight respite. So that really opened my eyes to pediatrics. And then since I was already in the healthcare field, in healthcare aid, assisting seniors, youth, and adults with different stages of disabilities and limitations, after I finished university, I got into social services. So I co-started a nonprofit that was sort of fizzling out, but needed new management. And while I was at university, I was also doing, I was a part of a management team for a nonprofit that was serving marginalized populations. So this new nonprofit ended up serving marginalized populations as well, and newcomers and persons with disabilities. So that's where I first got my legs into healthcare. And then as that progressed, life went on and I got married and was sort of getting ready to start my own family. And very easy pregnancy, everything was, fed and low risk. So I went to a low risk hospital to deliver. And shortly after, everything just went sideways. Yeah. I needed to be induced, which I was like, well, I can just walk around, you know, and it's a first pregnancy. So I kind of did a lot of reading and I was from I thought I was knowledgeable. But then again, you know, in hindsight, you never have enough knowledge.
Right.
So so I ended up getting induced, and I got an epidural, even though I said I wasn't going to do that. But when the pain kicked in, I needed it.
Yeah.
And that exasperated everything. And that was the initial wake up call for me of where the errors in healthcare start, especially for women in their birthing years. Mm-hmm. That induction led to an emergency cesarean. Right after delivery, I ended up suffering from severe upper between the shoulders pain, back of my neck, my left arm. And I called my attending nurse and I said, I'm just having a hard time breathing. Did I get my morphines this morning? And she's like, yeah, you did. You had instructed me to give it to you even though you were asleep. So I got it through IV. So the pain couldn't be explained by the cesarean. But guess what it was? I had suffered a massive heart attack.
Oh, wow.
And it only took, after much, much persistence, for my obstetrician to come back, who was teaching at the time, to do an ECG. That when that happened, the entire hospital staff was in my room. This had never happened before, but we were at a low-risk hospital. There was no space for a newborn, so I had to find somebody for the baby. I'm calling around because I had no family members in town. Rushed into surgery. They put a stent in. That stent exasperated my situation to 7 more heart attacks, where I ended up in end-stage heart failure and needed to be implanted with a left ventricular assist device, which is called an LVAD.
Wow.
So fast, within days. This is just, it went so bad, so fast. So with that, you're basically, your heart is not functioning. You don't have a heartbeat. You don't have a pulse.
You just had a baby. Tell everybody how old you were when this happened to you.
I was, I think I just turned 29.
Yeah.
So I was relatively, this was just like all too new, all too harsh for somebody who was planning to have a natural birth and wrap their tummy and go back to work, you know?
And Sudhi, not to get too personal, but did you have a partner?
Yes. I was married. I did have a spouse. So, and he was shocked. Like, he did not, obviously none of us planned for this. Right. So,
right.
I had to also calm down and calm him down throughout the process, because there's no support system for partners as your loved one is going through serious medical challenges, especially with childbirth. A lot of times just the father's just dealing with it, right? So all that aside, once I got into the, ended up needing open heart surgery, got the LVAD implanted. Yeah, so when all that happened, the LVAD basically is an artificial heart. It takes over all the work. So you're not, when you stand up, your blood pressure fluctuates and evens out. This doesn't happen. It was automatic 24/7 assist medical assist device. So that means that everything that you thought was healthy is no longer healthy, because it affects your level of nutrients, your vitamins in your body, and that especially with vitamin K rich food, which are green leafy vegetables and all these healthy food, is now dangerous for you.
Wow.
So I had to change everything. Like my entire lifestyle had to change overnight. And then you can't fall. You can't take a shower because you have an open exit wound that is easily, that's connected to your heart, that's easily infectable, right? So with that, if that wasn't challenging enough, I ended up suffering 2 TIA strokes with the machine, because the battery would just die. It wasn't manageable. And my body wasn't adapting very well. So I got expedited through transplant for heart transplant, only to learn that I had received so many blood transfusions and had so many antibodies throughout for the pregnancy and all that happened, I was not eligible for transplant. So I had 2% chances of being a recipient for a donor heart. So that also woke me up. I'm like, oh, and what they don't touch, that's not communicating the healthcare, is that organ transplants, some organs are ethnic specific. So I was born in Africa. I grew up in Canada, but my genetic profile does not specifically match the donor heart, right? Because it's coming from different populations that are than my own ethnicity group. So that just exasperated everything. So when that happened, I was like, what do we do now? I'm in this end-stage bridge machine that's giving me strokes, but at the same time, I am receiving TIS strokes, massive stroke, no further surgeries are happening, obviously, you know, because I already knew that, having dealt with people with disability. So we did a heart cath, which is that they open a little, your artery here, your jugular vein, they put a probe into your heart, and they have you turn off the machine. And if your heart can, if you can still function, you don't pass out, they check the ejection fraction, the pumping rate of the heart to see if it's viable, if you can maintain yourself. Thankfully, my heart recovered from 3% to 40%. I kid you not, I danced because I was like, this was my only life saving grace that I had. So that happened. And this is where I'm at still. My heart function is fluctuating around that area. There is no prospects of transplant, but the LVAD, the actual pump, is still in my heart. So I can't go through the airport, the, you know how they do the scan. Mm-hmm. If you have an ECG, if you have any mechanical things in your body, you really can't go through that. But that's, yeah, and that's, this is what's making me very passionate, that I don't know how much time I have, and I don't know how much time anybody has. But when you know you've gone through such, so close to death so many times, yeah. It just wakes you up to really be a health advocate for those that you can assist as much as you can. And women health issues, especially heart health and brain health, is under-researched, under-explored. And oftentimes, mm-hmm. when women go to the hospital and they have symptoms, they're told, oh, it's just stress, go home, lie down, take it easy. Right. And so dismissive, right? So yeah, that's what led me here.
And you had to learn so much about the heart and the brain and blood flow, and then all the things that you learned about transplants and, you know, race and transplants and coming from a different country and transplants and ethnicity. Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. But you had to, because your life was at stake. Still is.
It still is. And I had to do a lot of research just to find out that what I had was, it's called SCAD, spontaneous coronary dissection. It's so ridiculous that it has 80% mortality rate, but if detected on time, it has 70% survival rate, yet it's still under researched. So we don't know how many women are passing away from SCAD unless an autopsy is done after the fact and they find the tears in her heart vessels.
Wow. Well, March is Women's History Month, so we're going to talk about all these things for women. What gave you the strength and the power to, you know, at 29, be this amazing advocate for yourself?
Well, I had experience advocating for clients, right? Because of my nonprofit management, running that nonprofit that I was running at the time prior to all of this, as well as when I got hospitalized, the days I did feel good, I didn't want to just stay in my hospital room. So I would walk around and I would interact with the fellow patients. And I saw the dynamic of patients that did have a high support system, those that didn't, their mental state, emotional state, and how that was affecting their recovery. Some patients were recovering well and others were deteriorating, even though their prognosis and their projected success rate was higher than some other patients, especially seniors that didn't have a lot of visitors, were deteriorating faster because there's a psychosocial piece to healing, right? Oh, so that really opened my eyes.
That's very observant, especially again at a young age, even though you'd seen this at your work, but you were still so young and you must have been terrified. I mean, you've been through so much and you must have been exhausted.
100%. And often I think what drove me is my own desire to learn as much as I can so I can save myself, basically.
Sure. You had this new little baby to live for too. You know, I mean, if you don't want to live for yourself, you want to live for your child, for sure.
Yeah.
So what number one problem or issue do you think that you recognize with your doctors and nurses, with your healthcare professionals, did you find in that initial, in those initial experiences that you had with them? Did you feel that they weren't listening to you, weren't paying attention to things that they saw? What was the initial, what were the main problems?
I think the main problem was that there was no, I was suffering from a condition that was under-researched. So whatever they had in resources, when they looked to it, they couldn't find my profile of symptoms. That was a huge issue. So they would come back and they're like, we don't know what to do. We're going to try more painkillers, you know, try more morphine, try Dilaudid, try fentanyl, and we're going to try and manage the pain and we'll write it out. And I just kept deteriorating. And the other thing is that a lot of them didn't have the psychosocial training to deal with delivering such harsh news to a patient who relatively otherwise on paper should be really healthy. I didn't have any pre-existing conditions. I just had a baby. Why is this all happening? So, and in terms of when they try to communicate, they sent a psychologist and to my room, and I would explain what I'm going through. I feel like I'm in a twilight zone. I came to a hospital to deliver, and all this has happened in such a short window. And they're like, you know what, your emotions make sense. This too shall pass. And I'm like, that wasn't really helping me digest. I'm like, I am in the thick of it right now. That is not very supportive.
Okay. So then fast forward through some of these medical hurdles and you're starting to live with the problem that you have. You discover that you can live, I think you said, at 40%. 40%.
Yeah, 40, 45%. It fluctuates. But now I think after four and a half years, it's a little bit more stable. Mm-hmm. So if hopefully things, nothing new happens, we'll see. You know, there's nobody ever knows. So there is no other profile like me in the medical documentation to really look at.
So I'm always curious about where's that turning point for you? I ask this of people all the time because many people do a great job of grabbing hold of their own healthcare profile, but not everybody takes that and turns it into something else that goes out beyond themselves. Where is that turning point for you where you decide that I'm going to take this and I'm going to turn outward with it?
What did it for me that when it was such a hard decision for me to accept the open heart surgery and the LVAD transplantation. Once that happened, I was obsessed in finding out what an LVAD was because I never heard of it before. So I was looking and looking. I saw there was an article of a lady in her late 60s who had an LVAD, got explanted, and was now swimming because this water was very dangerous when you have an LVAD. And I was like, wow, she just empowered me and showed me that if this could happen, maybe there was a possibility for me too, you know? And then I remember I saw another young man on Ellen DeGeneres' TV show that was on an LVAD and was doing bodybuilding. And I was like, whoa, this, even though my condition is under research, we don't have the same condition, but we both suffer from serious health conditions that are needing an LVAD. I need to share my message because this could empower somebody else that might want to give up because they've got such a bad prognosis like I have.
Right. But you've gone beyond sharing your message. You've actually gone to becoming an expert and a coach and doing speaking engagements and becoming an advocate for other people. So yeah, where does that come in? Honestly, when did you decide to do all that?
That happened coincidentally. It's not something that I planned for. Initially, what happened was when I was in the hospital, because I had such a huge network, that one of a CBC reporter that I was a friend with said that, Tudy, can I cover your story? And he just went into the local CBC paper. And then after that, Heart and Stroke, which is like heart.org in the US, reached out to me and said, oh, we have, we would like someone for you to talk about your story. And I did. And that just sort of led to more and more different engagements. And then the government of Canada contacted me. So that's how really what happened. But when I was initially sharing, it was just to empower other patients that were in the hospital with me, empower people that are also just implanted with the LVAD like I had. And then it just sort of grew out of there. And the more I shared, the more I realized that, oh, women's heart issues and heart, and health challenges are underserved.
Definitely.
And that sort of propelled it.
So tell us a little bit about that. Tell us more about that. Why are women's health issues underserved?
Honestly, it's a very...
I know it's a complex question.
It's very complex, but the foundation of why is because a lot of health research is male dominant, right? The majority of health researchers are historically male. Not that to say that that's the case everywhere or that it's the case right now, but what happens is that there is a researcher bias towards issues that they know will get more funding in terms of publications as well, health like journals as well. So when that happens, that it sort of sifts out what they think will be more prominent and get the attention of more people. And in a way, women's health concerns are alienated because they're kind of dismissed in the sense that we've kind of conditioned women to carry the burden more than men. When a man gets sick, everything sort of stops for him and says, oh, we need to do research because that's where the funding and everything is coming from. But when it's a woman, it's sort of like, you're the caregiver, the family. You're the one that's holding everything together. And women also unrealizingly carry burdens beyond their capacity. So we also don't go to the hospitals and self-advocate that loudly as men do.
Yeah, we're just supposed to kind of take it. You know, when we hurt, we don't run off to the doctor. We just kind of stay home in pain because we're parenting and we're caregiving and we need to be able to do it all. So how do you live with chronic illness while you're parenting?
Honestly, that is something that I had to learn very fast. It is very difficult if you don't have a system in place. So one tip that I got initially as I was getting discharged, like housekeeping, because I was on an LVAD, so I couldn't bend over and do a lot of the movements that I not normally need to do, as my blood wouldn't fluctuate, right? I would faint or something, I would get lightheaded. So I started using, configuring my own cleaning tools, basically. Yeah. So I didn't need to bend over. And also allowing things to be, rather than looking at what needs to be done, looking at what is my capacity today. Like I know from this time to this time is my peak energy level and then I'm going to fizzle out. So what can I do today? And be happy with the little tiny wins and delegate as much as I can. If it comes to cooking, batch cook and be okay with that. If you're house cleaning, you do 15 or 10 minutes an area and move on and be okay with the fact that things are not going to be perfect. And I think a lot of times we suffer from perfectionism. We want everything to be perfect. We don't want nobody to know that we are in need.
Right.
So a lot of the advocacy that I do is that it's okay to say I need help because mm-hmm. you're human and humans all need help. And there's no human that's not vulnerable. By creation, we are vulnerable beings, you know? So
I love that. I mean, we just don't learn that, you know, we will burn ourselves out, but you know, it's one thing to burn yourself out. It's another thing when your life is at risk, from laundry. I like that. Laundry may kill me. So
yeah,
I'm going to use that on my husband. Laundry may kill me. Okay. No, I'm just making light of a subject that, you know, really makes everybody uncomfortable. So as you're dealing with this chronic illness, and, you know, for me, it was my daughter, Elizabeth, who faced an illness that shortened her life eventually. And having to explain that to family and friends, but also her sister. For you, it's, you know, talking with family and friends and potentially, you know, talking with your child. How do you talk to kids and other family members about illness, about life-threatening or potentially life-shortening illness?
I find the best way that has worked for me, and I've tested it on a number of, and it's, I think it's not a one shoe fits all.
Right.
But what helps is to put things in context from early on in terms of the parenting and education piece. So for me, what I did is from because this happened as my child was born, I would talk to my child about everything, not in a as an adult, but I would tell, oh, mommy doesn't have a lot of energy today because mommy has an owie. And even it was a 1 month old, 2 month old, didn't matter. Whenever I came out of the hospital, I would just communicate and say, you know what? Today we have energy for this. And I would put it in context. Oh, what do you want to do? Mm-hmm. And then later on when he got older and he could see my open heart surgery scar. And I said, you know what? You know how you get scratches? I had a really big scratch and this is where my scratch is. And then I had another a cousin of mine who is now 10, but he at years 8 years old. He ended up needing an open heart surgery as well, and mm-hmm. he took it really hard to know the fact that after surgery he couldn't play and have fun the way he could before, and he wouldn't mm-hmm. be able to go to school the way he used to go and play the sports and activities that he used to enjoy. So all we did is that we sat down and we said, you know what? Auntie Sudie has a big scratch on her. And this scratch sometimes limits her energy level. She can't do a lot of stuff because she has to be very careful. And now you have to be very careful because now you have a scratch and it's your duty to take care of yourself. And when you find out that you're getting tired, you just have to pay attention to yourself and say, oh, that's a cue for me to rest right now. And I don't have to compete. And life is not a competition.
Right.
So when my body needs something, I give it to it.
Okay. So meet people where you find them. And yeah, it is tough because all kids are different. All family members are different. I found that some family members were so uncomfortable. They just could not talk about it. They couldn't face it at all. And, you know, we just had to wait. And frankly, some people just never got to the point where we could talk about it. And that just has to be okay.
Yeah. And I think what helps is that the more, uplifting your spirit is, the more likely they're able to come on board because they see that mm-hmm. it's not this sad, gloomy thing that we have to hide away. Life
right.
happens. These things are going to happen. So what we can do is make the best of it. Like right now, about a week, 2 weeks ago, my father passed away and my sister is really struggling with it. She's not able
to. Sorry, sweetie.
Oh, I know it's I'm coming out of it. I'm not gonna lie, but my sister is really really struggling with it right now, and I just keep reminding her, you know what? He lived the best life he could. He was a kidney transplant patient. He mm-hmm. had blood pressure. He had diabetes. But look at the life that he was living. He was living to his fullest. And when you think of him, would you rather have him be in hospital for months and months and months and maybe even years, chronically
right.
ill, or do you want him to enjoy the little time he has? And then she's like, you're right. He had a good life. He had a good run. He was always happy. And
yes.
That's what I want to remember.
Yeah, definitely. Although I do want the audience to know that it's okay if you're not always happy and always in a good mood. And to expect that your people are going to rally around you sometimes, you know, it's okay to expect that.
Yes.
Okay. So, Sudie, I just wanted to, before we close out our interview today, I wanted to just get back to your coaching and self-advocacy and to make sure that we got the best out of you today. And to see if you could give us some final tips for parents and family members before we close out, what would you say your top two or three tips are?
One, go ahead.
Yes, go ahead, please.
One I would say is that you're the voice, where you have to be that solid voice of empowerment, because times are going to be hard. None of us are guaranteed rosy days and sunshine all the time, and be okay with it. You're not perfect. No one is perfect. And that, I think that's where it goes back to the vulnerability. Let down your guard and be vulnerable with the fact that this is happening. It's okay to cry about it. It's okay. And then after, when you do cry, you have to come up with a plan that says, this is one good thing I'm going to do, regardless of what's happening, right? And digest it in little tiny pieces. And I think that's one. Two, for the family members, not all of them, like Annette, you said, are going to come on board, but have the door open for them and know that, you know what, when the day comes that you're ready to talk about it, I'm here.
Okay, now for working with the medical fields, whether it's the doctors, the nurses, the organizations, what is your number one advocacy tip for getting what you need out of them?
Document everything. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yes, document exactly. Everything. Get the doctor's name, get his position, get the time lot, like, because a lot of them, they don't cross-reference and they don't check with each other. So what they'll do is that one physician from one specialty will come on a different rotation, a different physician will come, he'll do his own different assessment, and they won't cross-check what the other person did. And sometimes there's a conflict. And this is what I like from my personal experience. I'll tell you what happened for two cases. One, my father, he was really sick. He was in the ER and then in the ICU. And a doctor came, a pulmonary physician, and said that, you have cancer. We're going to rush you to surgery. Thankfully, because I had previously just gone out of the hospital loop, I called my sister and I said, you know what, get the doctor's name and then get the attending physician and attending nurse to sign, recheck what he said. That's what happened. In that process, they had to do new scans. And in those new scans, they found that they had a completely different patient. The doctor had been working such a long shift that he mixed the two patients up. Can you imagine that? It happens. So when you document everything and don't shy away from advocating for what your needs are and see that my child or my family member or I need another I need another assessment, or I need a second opinion. It could be 3-4 different opinions. If it happens that you have to go to a different state or different province or see a different hospital, and you have to physically take your documents with you, or pay, I had to pay for my own documents at one point. And I did it because I knew that was the only way I'm going to get accurate second opinion.
I totally agree. At one point, as we got closer to my daughter being near the end of her life, I sat in on rounds with the doctors just so that I could hear that they were all talking to each other and making sure that they were comparing notes. I'm not sure they would have done that if I hadn't been there, you know? They weren't all well-meaning, but they're so busy and there's so many cases, many cases, and they don't have time.
They don't have time. It's not part of their workflow. And two, right now, since the pandemic, there's a huge health human resource crisis that doctors are burnt out, nurses are burnt out, and everybody just wants to get through their day. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you as a patient or your loved ones need to get the short end of that stick. Right. You know,
people are dying.
Yes.
Literally dying.
Yes.
Dying. And it's not even that mistakes are being made. Yes. Necessarily, although some are, but that, you know, care is not being delivered, that people aren't speaking up, and just a lot of things are happening. So, Sudhi, do you have any last words of advice for us before I thank you so much and let you go on with your wonderful afternoon today?
Oh, yes. I would say in terms of the healthcare system, we should all be aware, and I speak for a lot of different, because I have different members of my family going through different cases, and I have I'm a part of a number of patient groups. This is not something that's just unique to Canada. There is a huge healthcare crisis happening globally, right. And with that healthcare crisis, as patients, it is our duty, each one of us and our loved ones to get the best care they can, as regardless of what's happening in, as a system breakdown that's happening internally within the healthcare system. And the only way we can do that is to be loud in advocating for our healthcare concerns and needs. And if sometimes what you want and what your body and your body, the bodies of your loved ones are telling you they need, you have to go and really push back and be okay with the fact that you have to push back, because their life depends on it and their wellness depends on it.
100%. So I will have all of Sudi's contact information in our show notes. She's got Facebook and Instagram, LinkedIn account. She's got some great videos on YouTube. She is phenomenal. I don't know how she does it given her own healthcare challenges and raising her child. So Sudi, thank you so much for sharing everything that you know and your life experiences with us here on Parenting Impossible today. We really appreciate it. We're very grateful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciated it too.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I just wanted to take a second to say how much I appreciate you taking the time to listen to these podcasts. I'm having a blast doing them, and I hope that you're finding the content to be what you were really hoping. If you are, please take a second to leave a rating and a review. It's so helpful in getting this content out to people who really need to hear it. Thank you so much.